This is the story. The amazing story of a man who left an indelible mark on American history because he rode a bull. And you'll hear another story. The astonishing story of a great mind that could grasp everything but mathematics. This is the story. He saw them waiting for him beneath the trees in front of his house. And though they were still some distance away, he thought that he could see the smirks on their usually solemn faces. He even thought that he could hear their mocking laughter. And as always, he felt his anger rising in him. What fools they were, these Puritans. The whole lot of them, including their governor, John Winthrop. Why should they find him so amusing just because he happened to ride a bull? Why, the beast itself, this strong, friendly, broad-backed creature that had just carried him to the village and back as it had done a thousand times before, it had more intelligence, more tolerance than the so-called Pilgrim Fathers. It, at least, accepted people as they were. It didn't demand that they conform to its own standards. But these Puritans, these stiff-necked blue noses who claimed that they had left England because they believed in freedom, they were ready to hold up to ridicule, ready even to persecute anyone who differed in the slightest degree from themselves. You rode a bull instead of a horse, and in their eyes, that made you disreputable. Muttering thus angrily to himself, the rider of the bull dropped to the ground and turned the animal loose to graze. As he strode up the narrow path toward the house, it occurred to him to wonder why so many of these Puritan neighbors of his had honored him with their presence. He even caught a glimpse of their governor among them. Well, he thought, whatever business they had, he'd see to it that they dispatched it quickly. He could get rid of them whenever he wanted to. After all, it was his property, his as far as the eye could reach, all 800 acres of it. He had been here long before they had arrived from England. He had been the very first settler in this part of the New World. He had been riding his bull along the shore and through the dense woods while they were still battling the wind and waves of the Atlantic. They were trespassers, all of them. They grew silent as he approached them. From out of their midst stepped their leader, their governor, to greet him with a feeble attempt at cordiality.
Greetings, neighbor Blackstone. We wish thee well. We found thee absent when we arrived, so we took the liberty of waiting for thee here. We thought that thou and thy, bull would soon return.
Neighbor Blackstone saw no need to be courteous. Let them state their business, he said, and be brief about it. They knew how he felt about Puritans, to which the solemn governor replied.
Aye, neighbor, we do know how thou feelest, and that is our business with you. We have long felt that thou art not a part of our community. Thou art different from the rest of us. Would it not be better if thou were to remove thyself from among us?
Remove himself? William Blackstone's cheeks grew scarlet with anger. Did they have the insolence to suggest that he should give up his property because they didn't approve of him? If they didn't like him and his bull, let them be the ones to go elsewhere. He would abandon these 800 acres of his for no man, especially if that man were a Puritan. But Governor John Winthrop raised his hand.
Patience! Patience, neighbor Blackstone. We have no wish to drive thee away. But we would purchase thy property if thou art willing to sell. It is our wish to build a city here on these acres.
Hearing this, William Blackstone suddenly reconsidered. After all, he thought, why not? What was to be gained by living here among these black-robed buzzards? What pleasure was there in it? Perhaps it was time for him to go into the wilderness again, as he had gone once before. Let them build their city. Let them forget him as he would forget them. And so, to their amazement, he blurted out his answer.
All right, Winthrop, it's all yours. And I don't want your money for it either. Just enough to pay me for moving my belongings. You can have it all. Every inch of my land for £30.
And so it was that the hard and bitter hermit, William Blackstone, the man who rode a bull, disappeared at length from the land that he had settled. And when he was gone, Governor John Winthrop told his followers,
let us wipe his name from our fair earth. He was not a man of God. He was a stranger amongst us. We will build our city here where his house once stood, and it will obliterate his memory forever.
And they believed sincerely that it would. At least they believed it until they began to plan the city. And it was then, when they appeared before the governor with their maps and their blueprints, that they realized they were mistaken. For John Winthrop pointed to the crooked, straggling lines that marked the streets of the new town and inquired why they could not be straightened And one of his followers replied,
"Because these are the paths that have already been cut through the woods, Master Winthrop. It would waste much time and money to cut new ones. These, sire, were made by William Blackstone when he rode his bull across his land."
And thus, ironically, the town which was to obliterate forever the memory of the hostile hermit served only to commemorate him. And so it still serves today. For the paths made by the ludicrous figure of William Blackstone as he sat perched on top his bull riding through the wilderness, those same paths have been preserved in the notoriously crooked streets of a great American city, the city of Boston. This is the story. From a distance, the boy who mounted the stairs looked like any other student on his way to class. You would have had to stand very close to him to note the difference, to see the pallor in his cheeks, the dilation of his throat as he swallowed and passed his tongue over his parched and trembling lips. And then, perhaps, you would have known. You would have realized that he was afraid, deathly afraid, that it was all he could do to force himself to go on climbing, to keep from turning around and fleeing in wild and uncontrollable panic. But somehow, he managed to reach the top. He went slowly down the hall to the last door. He opened it and stood paralyzed for the moment on the threshold. The other students were already there. He was the last to arrive. An instructor was moving down the aisles, handing out pads of blank paper. Another waited at the desk with a pile of mimeograph sheets on his arm. The boy stared at the sheets, and his terror reached its climax. On those, he knew, were printed the exam questions. Those held the key to his future, the answer to all his prayers, his and his mother's.
"Well, so you are back again, young man. I wish you better luck this time."
The boy whirled around. It was the third instructor who had spoken. And there had been a hint, just a hint, of mockery in his voice. And suddenly the boy's fear was gone, and in its stead came shame and mortification. Yes, it was true. This was the second time he had taken the exam. Just 3 months ago, he had come to this same room. He had been given a pad of paper and a mimeograph sheet. And for 1 full hour before he even picked up his pencil, he had stared at it in dismay and horror. He had not known the answer to a single question. He had not been able to work a single problem. His mind had gone utterly and completely blank. And that night, that desolate night 3 months before, he had gone back to his home. And there in the presence of his mother, he had broken down and cried and admitted that he was a failure. His father, trying in his own way to be kind, had pretended to dismiss it lightly.
"Ah, a failure, nonsense. So you don't have to go to the Polytechnic College, do you? You don't have to be a scholar? I never understood mathematics either, and I'm happy enough."
But that was when his mother's eyes had flashed fire. How dare her husband say such a thing? Her boy was going to be a great professor. She had said so from the day he was born, and she still said so. Why, even when he was a child, a backward child who had learned to speak later than other children, she had defended him, and despite the scoffing of her neighbors, she had predicted a brilliant future for him. A great professor! That was his destiny. And hearing all this, the boy's father had laughed tolerantly and said,
all right, Mama, have it your own way. So our son is a brilliant genius, even though he can't do simple arithmetic."
And the very next morning, the boy had started in again, cramming hour after hour, trying somehow to compensate for his failure. Always, it was his mother's faith in him that drove him on, and the fact that there was no basis for that faith, that he never had done anything from the days of his backward childhood to justify, made it seem all the more beautiful to him. He would pass the exam the second time. He swore it. He might not be a brilliant genius. He might never become a great professor. But at least he would give his mother the satisfaction of seeing him in the College of Zurich. And now, here he was again, back in the same room, the room of his miserable failure, and the moment of destiny was at hand. The students around him had grown silent. The instructor stood over him with the question sheets. If only he didn't grow panicky again, if only he could keep his head and remember what he had learned. There was a silent prayer on his lips. There was a vision of his mother's face in his mind. He picked up his pencil. Slowly, he began to write. It was the evening of the following day, after a brief visit to the college, that he came bursting into the living room of his home. His mother was sitting there. He pulled her to her feet with an exultant cry.
Mother, I've passed. I passed my mathematics exam. I'm enrolled in the college.
Yes, he had passed. He had finally mastered mathematics. And that's all there is to this story. And it would be very much like the story of thousands of other ambitious and determined students, were it not for one remarkable fact. 5 years later, that same boy was an instructor at that same college, an instructor in mathematics. 10 years later, he was a full professor. And in the days to come, he was to receive every honor that can be given to a scientist, including the Nobel Prize. For you see, the boy who couldn't grasp simple arithmetic, who struggled with it only to please his mother, was none other than the illustrious and immortal Albert Einstein, the discoverer of the world-shaking theory of relativity, and one of the greatest mathematicians the world has ever known. This is the story.